What I'd like to ask you first is, when you came to UBC, when did you first come to UBC, and what was the campus like, and who were your friends, and
Fairview Shacks. And of course, the first thing we were plunged into in the fall of 1922 was the big campaign to go out to Point Grey. Now, I imagine you've interviewed a number of people about that, and they've given you the yells we used and we relearned.
Oh, no, I haven't heard them yet.
A parade through town. I wish I could remember them. But we were freshmen.
This was in 1922.
The fall of 22. I had just graduated from high school. And some of my friends were there, but not very many, because many of them went to normal school. I was delighted I didn't have to go to normal school. I had a scholarship, and I can't tell you how delighted I was, because I had heard that when you went to normal school, there was a Miss Coney there who made you sing. And I was terrified of having to get up and have sing. So, also, we took a streetcar. You see, I lived in South Vancouver, and we had a streetcar, two streetcars, to get there. And the normal school people got off at to go up to the old normal school at 12th and Canby. And we went a little bit farther to go to the Fairview Shacks. And when they got off, they said, "We've got to hurry up, because if we don't get there in time, we won't have a pennant for our room." And I thought, oh, how disgusting, how stupid. Isn't it awful? How pleased I am to be at UBC. Well, anyway, we were plunged into the big campaign, and you've talked to Ab Richards, I think, and have...
No, I haven't yet.
But
no.
Somebody has. Lorenda told
Maybe
me.
Maybe Lorenda has.
Yes, I think so, yeah. Because apparently he gave them all kinds of things. And he was president of the Alma Mater Society, and there were people on campus in the fourth year then, like Betty Klein, Betty Somerset in those days, and Jack Klein, and all that group. And we thought they were quite something. And then we were, I've forgotten who our class president was that year. I should think of it, but I can't think of his name right now. But we had this tremendous parade downtown, and we were also asked to get signatures on the petition so that the university would be built at last. And we took up these things with great enthusiasm. I remember that it was around Fairview. I had a district somewhere around 14th, 15th, and Granville, as I recall.
And you canvassed door to door, didn't
door
you?
Door to door to get signatures, we all did. And then, very enthusiastically, I must say, they seized our imagination with all this. And so I remember that when I still had something, my petition to fill, when I got on my streetcar to go home over at Broadway and Kingsway. And so what did I do? I went from one end of the streetcar to the other, crowded streetcar, talked to the people, got my things filled. I may have filled a couple of petitions, I don't know. But I was very pleased with all that. So you see, we were enthusiastic.
Yeah.
And then we walked in the parade, and we went up to Point Grey, and I remember some of them were in a picture on the rafters of the or the girders, or whatever they had, just the skeleton of the chemistry building. But the rest of us were lined up to make the big UBC, the kind of thing they'd been doing lately. Mm-hmm. And so then we went back to our usual shacks in Fairview. They've all disappeared now. They were just where the big Centennial Pavilion is now.
Okay.
On 12th and Canby, Oak, 12th and Oak.
12th and Oak.
Yeah, and they had very makeshift buildings. The university had been there since its inception. And so we spent 3 years there waiting for them to build at Point Grey.
What were the buildings like? What was the interior like? Were they
just like the after the war, when they at UBC used the huts from that had been used in wartime, and there was one sort of a stone building. I remember there were certain things in that, but we had a great big wooden building where we had lectures from people like Sedgwick. That's one thing I told Lorenda about. that when they brought out this archivist calendar this year, I was very disappointed, and I thought they wasted a lot of money. I don't think I made it very unpopular when I said this, but then I don't have to worry about being popular anymore. And so, I don't know when I ever did. My tactful friends say I'm forthright, but others say other things. Anyway, the calendar doesn't bring out the people who were really important on campus way back then. There were people who were outstanding. It was a small campus, as you know. We went out there in the fall of 1925, and they had the inauguration of the university at that time. And they were bringing in people from Victoria, and I know Dean Buchanan, who was one of the big people on campus, an excellent mathematics teacher and a very dynamic person. We were all very fond of him. And he called some of us who were going to graduate in that year, fall of 25, we were graduating in 26, first class to graduate from UBC, to write out invitations to all the dignitaries who were coming to the opening. It was to be a big affair. And very sadly, the day dawned foggy, one of Vancouver's very foggy days. And we used to have ghastly fogs here when everybody burned coal and sawdust. And I remember emerging from the fog on that very important day were some of the greats of the campus at that time. Dr. Ashton, who taught French, who was all in his Cambridge regalia. Mm-hmm. Very fine person. And very good professor, because I had a lot of work with him. And also Dr. Clark, who was a good scholar, came from Ontario, spoke Ontario French, pardon me. You're from Montreal, so it doesn't matter. But he spoke correct French, and he was an excellent scholar. Excellent scholar. But then with Ashton on these committees was Sedgwick in English. Now, there was a man, not a single picture of these people in that calendar. And I said, why didn't they get a composite picture? There are none, said they. And I said, well, why didn't you take individual photographs of them? Sedgwick was I remember in my first year, somebody said to me, trying to get an interview one day, women were discriminated against even in those days. And I said, no, I won't buy that at all. And they said, well, look, you had women for your instructors. And I said, we didn't notice. We weren't aware of it. Mm-hmm. I did. But I said, Dr. Sedgwick gave what he called a distinction class for anybody who wanted to take honors in English. And I said, it was absolutely superb. We went once a week, and we would
Why was it so? Why was it superb? What was...
Well, Dr. Sedgwick could read a poem, and it would come to life. Mm-hmm. Now, he read The Wasteland the first time I heard it. I might have looked at it, but you know, he read it and the whole thing was illuminated. He was absolutely superb, and he read a number of poems to us and talked to us a bit, and many of us were inspired to go on in English. I had wanted to anyway, and I did take joint English and French honors until the end of my third year. And in that third year, I got most of the courses in English that were important. I had seminars, I had things with... Now, Sedgwick did a 19th century course, and he would read Matthew Arnold. He'd read anything like that, and it was wonderful. I took it as an extra because I had a very heavy program with the French as well. And I took his Shakespeare course at that time. Now, he would come in and just read Antony and Cleopatra, as he called it, not Cleopatra. And he would read any of these particular things. We were doing Hamlet, we did some of the great plays, and then we read some of the others on our own. And you ask people like Earl Burney and people like that who were in the same group, in the same class, Ted Morrison, who's now over on Pender Island, and they will tell you that Sedgwick could just read something, it came to life. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he was a great teacher in that way. I know with this 19th century course, he got too much work, and he gave it to somebody he picked up in the United States who was supposed to be very good. And I dropped it after a while because it wasn't the same with Sedgwick not there. And I didn't need it for any kind of credit anyway. But now the other greats, Buchanan, Lemmy Robertson for Latin and classics, Henry Angus, and people like that. They were on campus at that time. Now I think there's a little picture of Henry Angus somewhere, but not a big one. But they made the university. We got to know them very well because, you see, we had different clubs. Now, one of the most prestigious, we felt, was the Letters Club. Mm-hmm. And you were asked to join it, and you had to write a paper. And we had the hosts were generally wives of the professors or the professors themselves. And Mr. Larson was the sponsor. He taught English. And I know that we always had to be very correct about this. I was secretary for a year. Don't know how I did it with the other things I was doing. But I had to write meticulously polite letters of response to the hostesses after we'd been there. And also to negotiate with them about having us. And some of our favorite ones were... Mrs. McDonald, Billy McDonald, he taught English to a really sweetie, but his wife was charming, and also she had marvelous food. You know what that means to students?
I do.
Refreshments. But the Letters Club, you see, we met our professors there. Dr. Sedgwick also had people to tea. He lived with his mother. And... So these people were very, very important in the fall of 1926. And probably some others I haven't thought of, but, economics, Teddy Boggs, Dr. Boggs. Yes, that's another thing. After you've been to university for a year, you got wise to the good people and decided that if you were paying your money, you were going to have the best. And by that time, I'd become a reporter on the UBC and... friends like that, too, were very good for you. And so I had some instructor, or rather, was to be my economics professor, and although I wasn't going to specialize in economics, I thought, I'd like to go into Dr. Boggs' section. So I solemnly went to the registrar and said I had a clash. Couldn't possibly go to the one I was assigned to. And so I spent my time with Dr. Boggs, and that was lovely. Mm. He was marvelous. But I didn't go in for economics. I went in, dropped some of my other things, and went into the English and French. And then at the end of my third year, I had been talking to some of my friends. One was Wessie Tipping Lamb, Dr. Lamb's wife. And she'd been to France and had really enjoyed it. And I thought that would be interesting. And so I had taken some of the best English courses in my third year. I read up some French in the summer that I'd missed, and went into straight French honors in my last year, and had constant contact with Dr. Ashton, an hour a week as I was doing my dissertation. We called it our graduating essay at that time, thesis. And then also I was working on the UBC and in the Letters Club and doing a variety of things, and also doing a little job for the Dean of Women. Now, the Dean of Women we liked, but we wouldn't think of going, not my gang, to a Dean of Women about our problems, you know, counselors.
Mrs. Dean Ballert?
Ballert.
That's right.
Charming woman. We met her in our first year. She asked us, the freshettes, if we would serve at her teas. And, my dear, she said, you never go up and say, will you have... another cup of tea, even if they've had six. It's always, will you have a cup of tea? Never forget that. And also got lectures once about dancing. There should be a paper between the two of you. You should be able to. We thought this was terribly funny. But at any rate, she was a nice woman. And in our graduating year, she got some of us to come in, and she said that she'd like to get some money raised for the Women's Union Building. And I expect this appealed to us. Although we were not feminists, we liked the men just as well. I never have been a bra burner feminist, can't stand them. And then we went around to some of the business spots in town and asked for money and got it. It was quite an experience.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know where that money went. I think it may have gone later to the...
Did it go to Brock Hall?
I think it went to the Mildred Brock Room and Brock Hall,
yeah,
or the, something like that.
Yeah.
Because we had hoped that, you know, money was diverted. There was, we wanted a gym,
mm-hmm,
and we didn't have a gym. And Rifle, the beer baron, offered to build a gymnasium. But they were to call it the Rifle Gymnasium. And, of course, we on the UBC thought this was absolutely marvelous. Why not? You know, they had McDonald College from Tobacco in Quebec, and they had this and this and this. We thought it was a good use, but we had a prissy board of governors or something because they said no. That was it. They wouldn't take the Rifle money, so we had to try and raise money.
They didn't mind taking the Rifle money, but they didn't want the Rifle name,
right.
I guess.
Anyway, that was one thing. It was pointed out in editorials,
yeah,
in the UBC, I might say. Oh, yes, and when we first got out to UBC, after this opening ceremony, when half our guests were, I'm wandering all over the place, I hope, right, you don't mind, when half our people were stranded in midstream, you see, because they had to come over by boat from Victoria, thick, thick fog, and they couldn't get here in time. I've forgotten who spoke now, but that's beside the point. But they had an opening ceremony.
Well, Clink spoke, didn't he? But you mean...
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. He,
yeah,
was the president that time.
Yeah.
A nice man, but oh, so dull. He'd get up and say, this is an auspicious occasion. And, you know, his wife was rather sweet, too, but they were very formal. When I belonged to some alumni group later, you know, we felt he wasn't being assertive enough with Victoria, and we felt he,
mm-hmm,
should be removed. It was quite a movement for that,
mm-hmm,
in the 30s, early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
But he stood up for himself and stayed.
Mm-hmm.
And there it was. The best president UBC ever had was in that calendar. That was one good picture. Westbrook.
Westbrook.
Didn't meet,
mm-hmm,
him because he was gone before my time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I met his niece, his wife's niece, recently, and she had a copy of his book written by Bill Gibson, and a book about him. And I read it, and I thought, he has put down his aims for a university, which are just marvelous. They were just right to my mind. We haven't had a president like him since. Larry McKenzie, I was very fond of. But there were some others, but I mean, this was an outstanding man. It was just too bad that he died so young.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so where was I?
Well, the opening ceremonies up at Point Grey.
Yes, they were in the old auditorium.
Then. And you all had to sit on the floor because the chairs weren't
ready yet.
That's
right.
And then once that was over, where did you start to attend classes? Where were classes held?
Ah, now they were held mostly in what is now what we call the Arts Building, which was,
mm-hmm,
an adjunct of the, which was right along, you know, where the auditorium is now.
Yeah.
Well, there, that's where I used to hang out because the publications office was on the ground floor to the right as you went in.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd go across to the Arts Building, which is still there, I think,
mm-hmm,
yes.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a mathematics building now or something?
No, let's see, it's a mathematics. It's the old auditorium and the administration building and the mathematics building.
That's it. That was the old Arts,
yeah,
building.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we went there to classes. And then we went to the library, of course, right,
mm-hmm,
through the mud and over at the library. And, of course, John Riddington had the idea that he was not going to let us go through that main door with our muddy feet. We had to go through the basement. Well, the pub office had a meeting, and we weren't going to stand this at all. So we put on our gowns. You know, we all wore our gowns in those days because they kept you warm, and they hid your shabby clothes. Also, we wore gowns with a brown cord around them until we graduated, and then they took that brown cord off of me.
So you went to classes in robes?
In gowns, yes, in Arts 26. We certainly did.
Everybody wore gowns.
Well, they all did in my gang.
Isn't that interesting? Did you also do that at Fairview? Were you supposed to wear a gown?
I don't remember wearing a gown at Fairview. I certainly didn't in my first years, mm-hmm. but I certainly do remember them at UBC. We used to hang them on a peg in the mm-hmm. the UBC office, in the paper office, and the professors wore gowns.
Yeah.
I can still remember Dr. Clark coming in his gown and his rubbers and pacing around, you know, Dr. Ashton, and saying, only the great French actresses can do this, and then he'd read from Fed, well, you know, stroking his bald head. But he was really a good scholar. Anyway, we went to, so what we did was we simply put on our gowns one day and walked across the campus and just simply threw open the doors, the revolving doors at that time. I don't know whether they're still revolving.
No.
Going into the main library, we went in the main, because we thought it was so silly. And after some editorials in the UBC and a few things like that. So we bearded John Riddington, bless his heart. They say that they call it King John's Castle. I read that somewhere. Mm-hmm. I don't remember our calling it that. Mm-hmm. But I do remember that incident and also others. If we wanted to read certain books, he thought certain books weren't too desirable. You know, D.H. Lawrence was hidden on a special shelf and so on, away from public
days. Well, didn't he have a cage? Didn't he have a cage where he put these undesirable books?
He had somewhere. And we had access to the stacks as honor students. We all had our own place where we worked in the stacks. Mm-hmm. And out there, and it was lovely. You know I could open the window up. We had a beautiful early April that year, after that year, the spring of 1926. It was warm. And I remember we used to go down for a swim. Wreck Beach at those days mm-hmm. was respectable. And we didn't take, we wore bathing suits, but I remember my bathing suit hanging over a radiator in the pub. We'd all been down to the pub then was the publications office.
The pub is the publications office, mm-hmm. because I've heard references to it.
Oh, the pub is in the sub now. The pub in those days was the publications office on the main floor of the old auditorium building.
All right.
And you see, you go in, and here was the pub office on the right, very accessible, and that's a nice big office. That's where we used to hang out.
Now, you were associate editor.
Senior editor
for 3 years on...
No, I worked there for 3 years, but in my last year, I was senior editor, but I worked there in my second, third, and fourth year.
Now, how did you have to do a reporting and enter a contest to be chosen to be a reporter on the UBC?
I think we did. I know I had to write something or other, and we were chosen. And that was my first year, my second year. I didn't do this in my first year at university. No. I thought I fancied it in my second year, mm-hmm. and that's what I did. And then I became a reporter and was given assignments. In the third year, I think I had something or other that was more responsible, but I still did reporting. And then in my fourth year, I had to get out the Tuesday issue of the paper. And
so what did that involve?
Write editorials.
Yeah.
And then we all went down on Monday night from Point Grey. Johnny Grace was a great joy because he had a car, one of the few on campus. Otherwise, we had bus, streetcar to downtown to the printers, and we put the paper to bed down there. And then that would be Monday night because the paper came out on Tuesday. Now, Billy Murphy did that for the Friday edition. So we had a Tuesday edition and a Friday edition. And then the editor-in-chief was Earl Burney, and he'd come and look over things and so on and write editorials. But we could run our own show on mm-hmm. Tuesday. And sometimes it was a good play on at the Lyric Theater. And, of course, we didn't miss any of that. We'd go up there, having had some pie or something downtown. the printers and paper put to bed, we'd all climb all these steps and go and look at Martin Harvey doing a play. And Darcy Marsh was one of the people on the, and he was really a very amusing person. And he would have enormous old field glasses, that's all you can call them. And we'd try to get up in the front row of the gods and we'd sit down and watch everything. And you know, I remember those things. Somebody said the other day, did you look at those things on the Knowledge Network, the Oedipus series? And I said, I didn't think I could bear to look at another Oedipus. We did see Martin Harvey do it. And fortunately, there was no role in the play for his enormous wife. She did play Ophelia, by the way, and convulsed us when they brought in this tiny coffin for this enormous woman. But he was wonderful as Oedipus Rex. And I said I saw another one at Stratford in the East when James Mason played it. So I don't think I could take another one. But I did look at the third of that series, by the way, when they did Antigone, and it was superb. Mm-hmm. However, that's a modern aside.
What was it like working with Earl Burney? And
oh, we enjoyed it. I mean, we all got along together. And
What was he like?
He wrote extraordinarily good essays. I know that in our second year I was in the same group that he was in under Freddie Wood. He took us for the essay writing, and then we had specialists in the field do the different parts of English literature. It was kind of a survey course of English literature. We had MacDonald, we had Walker, we had Sedgwick. And we had Larson, you see, doing bringing us up on the different periods. But I was so impressed when I heard one of his essays read out by Freddie Wood. And then he belonged to a group that we belonged to, the Letters Club, a picnic group in the summer. We used to go up and have picnics up at Caulfield's. And there was a man who was in the library called Mr. Hoyes, H-A-W-E-I-S.
Mm-hmm. Lionel Hoyes.
Lionel Hoyes, and he had this little group. We used to meet at his house. We used to go up and have picnics up there. And he had this group called Ganesh. I don't know, I've forgotten now. But it was Phyllis Ross, who used to be the, John Turner's mother. She was a year ahead of me, and she'd be up there with some other people. And different people, you know. We'd go up there on a Sunday and sit around and talk, thinking we were terribly important and having a good time, too. But the Hoys were charming, and Mrs. Hoy's an enormous woman. We always took food, though, because otherwise, how could she feed a great bunch of hungry people like us? And then we'd drive up once we got cars, or we'd take the train. Mm-hmm. You go on North Vancouver Ferry, and you take the PGE, as we called it then, up to Caulfield and get off and go down, spend the day at the beach and with them and so on, talking and eating and just enjoying ourselves, swimming. We all swam. And then...
And Earl Burney was part of that group?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And, oh, my, yes. He was one of the... knew him very well indeed. Mm-hmm. And we all separated, you see, when we graduated. He went on and did English. And I went straight to France.
Now, you went to the Sorbonne.
Yes, to the Sorbonne. And then I came back, you see, and went straight to Victoria, where I had my first school. I thought I had to make some money. And so I had to get a job. So I remember writing applications to Victoria and was appointed in Vancouver and Victoria. But I accepted Victoria first, so...
And you taught at Victoria School?
For a year and a half, and then they wanted me back in Vancouver and various things. And so I came back to Vancouver and taught at King Edward High School. And then I taught at the university from 1940 on part-time. I used to go out after school or on weekends.
Well, you did your... Then you came back to UBC and did your MA. Is that...
Oh,
that
my dear, right? I didn't come back or take a year off or anything like that. Sabbaticals, I have never had one in my life.
So you taught and did your MA at the same time?
That's right. They gave me a minor for the work I'd done in Paris because I had the scholarship to go and do that. And it was a very good, demanding course. They started out with a great number of people, and they certainly weeded them out. And we had written exams for that, and if you passed them, you were allowed to do the orals. And then you were given in going that year to Paris, to every museum we could think of, to all the theaters of every kind, they were all reasonable, and, you know, I had energy and enterprise in those days. And from doing all that, you still had to think that you wanted to do pretty well on your exams, and I was fortunate. But at any rate, I got credit for that for part of my MA. And then, you see, I had no teaching certificate, none at all. I'd never been in a classroom. And so they appointed me in Victoria, and I taught there, as I say, for this. And then I came to Vancouver, and there was some, whenever they put down type of certificate, I just wrote specialist. That's what I thought I was, and that's what I got. So then we had a very unfriendly Minister of Education, Hinchliffe, who terrified the university too, and cut grants and all that sort of thing. And somebody said, what about your academic certificate? I said, I haven't got one. What have you got? Specialist, I said. So anyway, I went out to see the man, Dr. Weir, who was head of education out there, and explained this to him. And before that, I wrote to Victoria, to the registrar, Mr. Watson, and I said, look, I've never had a teaching certificate, I'm just teaching. And you can come back to university later if you want to. But at any rate, on the teaching business, I wrote to Mr. Watson. And he said, he wrote back, come in out of outer darkness and send me $5. And I did, and I got a specialist certificate. So that's what I wrote. Well, then I decided I better have an academic. So I went to see Dr. Weir, and he said, you could take some education courses at summer school. You have enough. You're doing a dissertation, a graduating MA with Dr. Clark. In my spare time, I was working on that. Mm-hmm. And he said, what you can do is take these education courses at summer school. I'd never had one in my life. And so I looked the calendar over, and I told him I didn't fancy much, but I'd rather like to go down to Berkeley. So he picked out some courses at Berkeley, abnormal psychology, personnel and character testing, guidance. And so I went down there and spent the summer at Berkeley and enjoyed myself. Loathed the courses I was taking. I thought, gosh, they've got one idea. And they spend a whole book writing about it. Didn't like them at all. The abnormal psychology was all right because we had a Canadian for that. He was a bit abnormal himself, and the course therefore was a bit, you know, it was a fascinating bit. But I managed to get A's in those things, how I don't know, and came back here and got my academic certificate, so that was looked after. And then when I finished my thesis, I got my MA. I hadn't hurried with that. As you know, it was 1936 before I took that. But I didn't take a year off, you see. Mm-hmm. I just
kept
never
on.
Could afford it, I guess. Yeah. And then I was asked by Max Cameron, to go out to UBC and lecture to the people who were graduating to become teachers of French.
Wow.
And so...
So you taught teachers how to teach French.
That's right.
And you ended
I
up writing...
I had never had education myself. But I was very fortunate. When I went to Victoria High School, I had a very nice woman who was Mary Hamilton, dead now, and she... gave me a tremendous amount of help, because here was I, a young teacher, and what happened was that I was supposed, as a young teacher, to have some beginning classes, but the head of the department took ill, and I was handed two senior classes, matric, you know, grade 12, right away. So I had two of them and some of all the others, and The principal was Ira Dilworth, who was an exceptional person. I think he's the only person who ever inspected me in all my years of teaching who knew anything about French.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the regional directors for CBC here, and he taught English at UBC later. And so anyway, I never regretted having spent some time in Victoria. Now, you wanted to come back to UBC, and some other questions about that?
Well, there were a number of other questions I wanted to ask you. One was about you as a teacher, and a professor at UBC, and then you were associate director of secondary education, and I wondered what that involved. From 1963, in the calendar, it has you as being associate director of secondary education.
Yeah, that's right.
And I wondered what that involved.
I went out, first of all, you see, I'd been going out doing what I... then they established the College of Education out there. And I went out then, but I went on a year's leave of absence from the school board. Didn't know whether I was going to like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
But I decided I would stay, and... when I became Associate Director of Secondary, that was arranging the secondary program. People who were coming in to do, they got a Bachelor of Education. I think they've changed the program now, but it was a five-year program. They had 4 years in which they got up their majors in teaching subjects or honors in one.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to have an average of at least 60% in the senior courses before they could go on.
Mm-hmm.
We put them on probation. We did all kinds of things to really keep up the quality of that. And we watched their programs so they'd have some literature and some writing in French and some structure of French. And they couldn't just take anything, you see. And also, so that was part of my job, to interview all lots of people of that kind. And to also look over all the applications with the director, Dr. McIntosh, of the who coming in from all over the world to take the one-year program for graduates.
Oh,
that was quite a business.
Mm-hmm.
And then we, I enjoyed that, I really did. And then when I retired in 1971, you can't go on with administration once you retire. And I could have gone on with the teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And they often urge you to. But I don't believe in it. I think when you retire, you get out. You must leave room for the younger people. That's why I'm not at all happy about so many people hanging on out there after they have been 65.
Mm-hmm.
They're not allowing any room at all for the younger people.
Mm-hmm.
Feel strongly about that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I used to think it was rather pathetic when people, in my younger years, when people turned up after 65 and sort of clinging to the place and hanging about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I was fortunate. When I retired, I was invited to go with my goddaughter's parents from England to Peru, and to because their son had written The Conquest of the Incas, and we were going to meet in Machu Picchu and all this. Anyway, that's another story, and I was also invited to go to England after that and drive. So I took off, and somebody took my place. And I mm-hmm. came back, and when I came back, this person was ill in the spring, and the dean phoned me from education and said, please come back and teach until she's better. And I said, I'll come back, and I'll teach, but I don't want any money at all. I just want to go and enjoy myself. And I did. I taught. I liked that class. They were. I just there for about a week.
Mm-hmm.
But this was very pleasant. Then they used to beg me to go out and do practice teaching. But I said, no. It has nothing to do with me. I haven't prepared them and so on. So that was, I probably answered that question.
Now that, I have some other questions.
Very verbose.
No, it's wonderful. You wrote a textbook with Ruth White, Chacun son goût, and I wondered what inspired you to write the book. And
well, I tell you, I first of all started quite accidentally to write things for radio,
mm-hmm.
and wrote school broadcasts for years for the when I was still in high school. And we produced them at CBC.
That was called Écoute.
Écoute.
And you won, yes. You won an award for that.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, the producer was much more. But anyway, I had very, some of my own students were on that, particularly people. One of them's a dentist in Vancouver now, Serge Vanry. He came over as Serge Vanry, but I think he was a Jewish boy who'd been brought up in France and came out at the time of the war. And but he spoke excellent French, of course, and mm-hmm. he could take the leading role in some of these. And then we had anybody else who had any talent in that way, that we trained them, and they went down, and we produced them down at CBC. And
so
we had
what was the program about? What happened on the program?
It was about all kinds of different things. There might be a dramatization of Maria Chapdelaine. There might be, there was I created a character called Gaston, who had funny adventures, and he, that was the first thing I wrote for high school, a reader, based on these broadcasts at the, because I'd have, you know, publishers are always coming wanting you to write a textbook or do something, and that was the first thing, and I wrote that on my own, and I'll show you a copy later mm-hmm. if you want to see it. Mm-hmm. And it was picked up by Longmans in Britain, and there's a text in, it was a British reader there for, I don't know whether there's, I'm still getting some royalties from somewhere, but very few, because you know these things. But this took Gaston on all kinds of silly adventures, which appealed, I hope, to high school students. I know it was used. And but the Écoute programs were on various things, you know. As I say, we often dramatized something, or we had a few songs on them. I remember once we had Mila Andrew, who sang in opera in Europe later. She was in my class, and they wouldn't let her be accompanied because they'd have to have a musician, and they couldn't afford to pay a musician. So she sang on it. Unaccompanied, Ma Normandie, did it very well too. But no, that was the beginning. And then, you see, after that, they wanted a textbook for grades 11 and 12 of reading selections. Mm-hmm. And that was Chacun son goût. And Ruth White was in on that with me, and Gertrude Langridge. They all contributed things, and we worked on it together. And they used that until a few years ago. Mm-hmm. They always have to get something new.
Yeah.
But the trouble was, we meant it to be used as it was used, the way we taught French when I was still teaching in high school. We tried to, by grade 12, to get the students to do some explication de texte and to discuss the stories in French and answer simple questions on them and all that kind of thing. Well, then, you see, they no longer had matric exams for everybody, and we discovered that in many schools, what they were doing was simply translating those stories into English and doing no work on them in French at all. Some people are naive enough to think they can trust teachers. You can't. An A in one school is a C minus in another.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
I do.
But at any rate, that if you want to see those things, I've got some in the...
Oh, well, I would. I'd like to look at them.
Yeah, surely. Would you like some coffee now?
Sure.
Just take...
So now I'd like to ask you a little bit about the Faculty Association. I know you were vice president at one time. And the
That's right. I enjoyed that very much. Somebody nominated me to be the secretary, first of all, and funnily enough, nobody likes to be secretary of anything, and I got it. And
this is caught. Sorry. Okay.
And it was the time when Larry McKenzie was president, and some of the people in the Faculty Association at that time, one was, what was his first name? Carruthers. And not Brian, but it'll come to me. That's silly. And he was excellent. he would have made a good president of UBC. But he was in law, and he went on to do something in Calgary and something in the East. I think he's in some position in the East now. But he was president of the Faculty Association, and I think I'd stayed with it, you see, and I think by that time I might have been vice president, when the Faculty Club was opened in 1959. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the Queen came for a visit. I suppose you heard about that. And
yes.
She dined at the club. And we had to, the other woman in the party was Margaret Fredrickson, who at that time was Larry McKenzie's secretary. And then the executive of the Faculty Association, or president, and myself, vice president myself, we met the Queen upstairs in where the president now entertains, and which at one time was a very lovely room, but they business-oriented people on the board or somebody have transformed that perfectly lovely top place into what looks like a BC, oh, not BC, but Canadian Pacific boardroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they did give money for it, but at any rate, I think it's appalling. Mm-hmm. And as one of my colleagues at the time, Sidney Friedman, who retired from medicine, I met him one day and he said, "Full of sleaze, it's dreadful." And I said, "You're absolutely right, that whole top floor is just awful." And it used to be a very nice room. Anyway, we met the Queen there. She rested at the other end of it. And then we had the banquet downstairs in the Faculty Club, and it was a great event. That whole floor was where they had the tables set. It was a lovely dinner, and by the man, Mr. Carroll, who used to be the manager of the club. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid the club is in a bad patch right at the moment. You know, the food is appalling, and so on and so forth. Anyway, and expensive. After that, the Queen left in the evening and went to Victoria, and we all stood up top and watched her go. And so that was one of the little episodes in the Faculty Association. And I mention it again because for some reason or other, that the pictures commemorating it, showing the President walking downstairs with the Queen, that was one of them. Another picture showed Mr. and Mrs. McKenzie, President and Mrs. McKenzie, with the Kerners, who gave the club. And they were in, as you walked up the stairs at the top, they were right at the end near the Royal Suite. They have disappeared. Now, those are historic pictures. They never should have been taken down.
And oh, they're probably in UBC archives.
What good are they in the archives, for heaven's sake? They should be right there.
On display. Yeah.
Yes, of course they should. It's mm-hmm. ridiculous. So anyway, we felt, a number of us felt disturbed about that, and I've mentioned it at various times. I'm not saying anything about the Faculty Club that I haven't said to the manager himself mm-hmm. quite recently. Mm-hmm. So anyway, let's see now, Faculty Association, I'll get back on
what
track.
We
had some interesting people on that.
Mm-hmm.
Doug Kenny was on it. He later became president. He was mm-hmm. part of the group that we all had many executive meetings and things together, and presenting briefs for salary increases. I know.
Was that a big issue at the time,
late 50s? It was, because when I went out to UBC, the salaries of high school teachers were better really than the ones of the university professors, but there was a big movement to get better salaries, and Freddie Carruthers, and there were some others there who were very good, Stu Jemison and a few like that, you know, they prepared briefs, and I know one year I had to go to the Board of Governors and present it, and got lots of encouragement from Larry McKenzie. He told me one day, "You should have run for president," but I said, "I've got too much work in education. I just mm-hmm. had this extra job loaded on me." And besides, who ran for it but Cyril Belshaw. I think maybe I better not say anything about Cyril Belshaw, or do you know the story?
Mm-hmm.
And one of my friends who knew him pretty well said, well, who did it? Anyway, there you go. But at any rate, I knew Cyril well. We knew, we really took up issues. Another issue that interested us very much was faculty participation in university government. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now that came to a head when under the dentist who succeeded Larry McKenzie, wait a minute, isn't this stupid now? I remember his name perfectly and it'll come to me. But he was the next president of UBC after mm-hmm. McKenzie. Mm-hmm. And he was terrified of student participation in university government or faculty participation in university government. And we had committees of the Faculty Association that went into this kind of thing, because I worked on them after I gave up the executive jobs because I didn't have time for them.
Oh, so you kept up
after? Oh, yes. I was in several committees, and I was on the Personnel Services Committee. So I did a lot of work with them. My feeling was that when you went out to the university, you just didn't stick in your own department.
Mm-hmm.
You did all kinds of cross-campus mm-hmm. things if you had time for them. And I met a lot of my own friends that way who were in other positions on faculty. And also it was a means of keeping up, and I was interested.
Was faculty housing also an issue at the time? Was that some of concern?
No. Mm. In faculty housing, not really.
No.
Not at that time. Student housing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't remember faculty housing, though.
Mm-hmm.
Not an important issue at that time.
You were chairman of the Committee on Committees at one time. Do you remember what...
The Committee on...
You were chairman of the Committee on Committees. And I wondered if that was some kind of membership...
I don't remember being... Well, that wasn't on the Faculty Association. Maybe on the Board of Governors.
Maybe it was just... this I read in the Faculty Association papers, but it looked like it was more like a nominating committee to get all the members of the various committees
that might
committed.
Have been it. Yes, I don't remember. Yes, that might well have been getting different people across campus to participate. But I did, I enjoyed my time with the Faculty Association and met a lot of interesting people.
Were there a lot of other women on the committees, or were you the sole representative?
Margaret Prang was on several, and got to know Margaret well that way. And, what's her name? There were other women, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
Marion Smith was a very active member in the old days. Mm-hmm. She went east. She was taught in the English department.
Mm-hmm.
And but she died some years ago. And Margaret Ormsby,
mm-hmm.
she was head of history at one time. Mm-hmm. She's retired.
Mm-hmm.
There were some other women. Yes, there really were.
Now, the other... a board that you were on was the Board of Governors from 1975 to 1979,
That's
I think.
Right. Mm-hmm.
How did that come about? How did that arise? And
I received a call from Victoria. Would I consent to serve? I don't know who pushed it or what happened. I didn't try.
Was that out of the blue? Were you surprised?
I was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was. But it was interesting, and when I got on it, of course, I got on a great men number. It was under Walter Gage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was a good president. It really was. And he was president for about a year or so after that, but he retired, and then Doug Kenny took over, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And then McDonald was the name of the dentist
that's
mentioned.
Yeah.
Yes. Doug Kenny isn't at all well now, I don't think, but I saw him at the market one day with his wife, and he was
mm-hmm.
coming along. But at any rate, he was president during most of the time I was on the board, and I was immediately put to work on committees. Secretary, but that was purely honorary. I just had to go and sign things. That was
mm-hmm.
all. Go around different places and or they brought them to me, or Nina Robinson, who was the clerk of the board, an absolutely magnificent gal. Mm-hmm. And she raises horses in her spare time with her husband out in Alderville. Anyway, she is still looking after them, mm-hmm. one president after another.
I think J.V. Klein was on the board.
Oh,
he
yes,
was chancellor at the time,
yes,
wasn't
absolutely.
He?
He was chancellor for part of the time. I had some interesting people. I had Sonny Nemetz, you know, Nathan Nemetz, the Chief Justice. I'm fond of him, too. And then there was Tommy Doan. He was mm-hmm. chancellor for a while.
Mm-hmm.
We had some interesting people on the board, too. We had Sven Robinson. You know
mm-hmm.
Sven?
Mm-hmm. He was a student representative at
the
time.
He was a student representative, kept the meetings going till far beyond where they'd ever gone before, because he wanted us to vote on censoring the buying of California grapes because of the unions down there.
Mm-hmm.
Irrelevant things like that. And then once he revealed some of these statistics that we'd had on salaries and things of that kind, and I think he was on the Jack Webster show, and I think he resigned before they kicked him out of the board.
So he was revealing things he shouldn't have revealed.
Yes. And Sven is still going on, you know. He's bright.
Yeah.
He's very bright. But mm-hmm. he's lacks judgment. Let me just put it that way. But you could say anything to him, and I did. Yeah. You know, we enjoyed having a little bit. I haven't seen him for years, though, except on television. And we were talking about presidents.
Well, and the other people who were on the board, Donovan Miller at one time was...
Oh, very, very fine man. Nice man. Yeah, I often see him around. He's working for this big 75th anniversary mm-hmm. celebration, I think.
What were there any big issues when you were on the Board of Governors?
Fees, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they were worried about that. Of course, we were working for larger pensions for some of the people who had retired. I was on the pensions board, sitting with a number of professors of economics who never agree among themselves, so it's fine. You have to be a little, have somebody there that can bring them down to earth once in a while. But you have, they have a good chairman now, is Bill Wood,
mm-hmm.
who is... Freddie Wood's son.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
He's in commerce. Now, then they had, for a time, the Best Teacher Award.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody in faculty got, I've forgotten how much money. It was donated by Walter Kerner. Let's say it was $5,000. But to the, somebody who was judged to be the best teacher on campus.
Mm-hmm.
He was nominated by students or whatever. And then the names came to the attention of a committee. And there were various members of the committee. It was a friend of mine at Arts was the chairman. I wondered if I'd go on the committee. And I did for some years. And I went in and visited different professors and gave my opinion. Several of us went. So we had a...
Oh,
bit of consensus. But then they stopped giving the money, and so they didn't have it anymore. And, you know, it's a funny thing. It's a very, to give an award like that, many people, I often felt, were not nominated who should have been. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And some went out of their way to be nominated.
Yeah.
And so I think the thing lapsed, but
mm-hmm.
it's all...
Was this the Master Teachers Award?
Master Teacher.
Yes,
that's
right.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
that was it.
Yeah.
But I went into some very interesting lectures and saw some nice people.
And what other things would you have done on the Board of Governors?
I was on the hospital committee for a time. And, they, of course, went to all the meetings. Now, what other committees that took me out on campus?
So on the hospital committee, what would...
That was when they were opening up the new hospital.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And Walter Kerner was the chairman.
Yeah.
Yes, and we were talking about different policies there. But, of course, a lot has
mm-hmm.
happened in that since. They've amalgamated with Shaughnessy
mm-hmm.
and all sorts of things of that
mm-hmm.
kind.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to think. I know I was kept busy with committees and had a lot to shuffle off when I retired, but I'm trying to think what else there was. Oh, committees on campus. For years I worked on the Canadian University Students Overseas. And we had to interview candidates and send them off to Sarawak or Kenya or Nigeria or whatever, you know. That's rather interesting. But I don't know if they still have that or not. I doubt it.
Well, CUSO still exists, but I don't know how it's organized.
It was very, very lively in the late, in the 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah, very lively.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, but, no, I enjoyed the work of the board, and the meetings sometimes lasted too long because some people prolonged them with things that weren't really... we weren't really concerned with. No, I thought Jack Klein was a very good chancellor. He was also a very interesting man, as you know, because he always felt that the Canadian Bill of Rights was going to produce problems and that the country would be governed not by Parliament, but by the courts. And that's exactly what's happened. And he wrote some very interesting papers on this and distributed them to us. I was grateful for them. Made sense.
Just in conclusion, maybe you could compare a little bit university over the years as you, when you were first as a student and then a professor and later on the Board of Governors. Have you seen a lot of changes,
yes,
the good,
too,
the
it's
bad?
Too big. Or? It's really, now, it was interesting. I had a student I had in high school who went to, she came here the other day from Australia where she'd been for 26 and a half years. I'd seen her when I was down in Melbourne once, that in the interval. She was a student of Dr. McTaggart Cowan in zoology. She went down there to get her doctorate in zoology. She met an engineer and she married and has four children, and I think she did the right thing. Somebody used some of her work and acknowledged it when they wrote their thesis, so that was good. But she was out the other day with me, and she'd been to see some of her old professors, and she said, it's too big today. Just too big. And you see, she was there in the late 50s and 60s.
So even compared
found, to... She found it very difficult to... And you see, they have this graduate student center. And she used to be over there constantly because she was president or something or other and had graduated and got her MA and taught for a year in the department, and so she knew something about it. And she said, it just looks so different today. And she said, there don't seem to be so many coming over. And I said, I inquired about that and discovered that many of them had little holes and corners in their own departments away over somewhere else on the campus. Campus is so scattered.
So it's more like departments now, where you know people in your own department. Did you have any vision of how, what you'd like the university to become when you were there in the 20s and 30s? I mean, there must have been some ideal that people were aiming for.
Yes, exactly. Just have a look at what Westbrook said about it, and that's what we were hoping for.